This is XTP Media.
Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
You're listening to Extended. Hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 46 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. Today's show is going to be a little different. It's an extra episode and we're going to talk all things space. We've got a great panel, and first on that panel we have talking space host, space journalist and out of this world expert Gene McCulker. Gene, welcome back to Extended.
Peter, thank you. It's always a privilege and an honor to talk to your audience. Thanks so much.
And to complete the team today, we also have a lifelong supporter of space exploration, a STEM ambassador, Amjad Zardi. Amjad, welcome back to Extended as well.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's an honor to be back.
Coming up on Extended, we've got lots of news stories and updates. We're going to talk about manned and unmanned missions, space exploration missions, and also some of the debating points that have come up over recent weeks and, in fact, days, such as investment and manned missions to Mars. I'm sure we'll creep in there too as well. We also want to have a look at UK astronaut Tim Peake preparing for his mission to the ISS in December. But before we do that, we didn't want to start this episode without taking a few moments out to mention the event last week at Shoreham. We have noticed a lot of comments about support for those affected and ways in which people can show their support. There is a book of condolence which can be signed, and there's also a community fund if you want to make a donation. Both can be found at shorehamcondolence.org. I'll put that link in the show notes if you've missed it. Now, many of our very close friends and colleagues have been deeply affected by this event, but Amjad, none more than you, you were there. How are you?
I'm going through a process at the moment, Peter. Thanks for asking. I actually was, like many people in the crowd, mere hundreds of yards away. The initial shock, the sting is fading, but I'll always remember this. Like many who were at Farnborough in 52. So, I mean, I still do remember it when it came down and there was that inkling that something was wrong, and then the full horror hit when we saw it crash into a double fireball as it split in two. But my thoughts are all going out to the town of Shoreham, the people who will never come home again, their families and all those affected and beyond. And obviously wishing Andy Hill a speedy recovery.
Yes, it's certainly a challenging time. We know the social media and press coverage has been very variable.
I think is
a way of putting it. I think there's a very strong groundswell to show, I think, that condolence and respect. It has been quite amazing.
Yes.
And we saw yesterday the show of remembrance and the silence.
Yes.
And in fact, the silence that was shown at several air shows around the country as well. And we do know that there is a very strong drive, particularly from some of the tabloid press, to put pressure on those air shows not to take place. And there are some interesting responses that people have positioned themselves on. But where are you on this, Amjad?
Well, I am fully behind air shows continuing. Obviously, there is a need to have a full and rigorous scientific investigation, which requires time and patience for the truth to come out. But we should never have any knee-jerk reactions towards this. It's been the toughest season for UK air shows. But why? Who knows why? There are rules and regulations that are tighter than ever. We know safety is paramount. There are checks on all planes, including vintage planes. They're incredibly thorough. Perhaps it was a failure of imagination on all of our parts that a crash can happen on a road. But as far as I'm concerned, Andy Hill is a hero. He did his best to fly that plane, control it as much as he could. And he avoided crashing into the crowd, avoided crashing into the town of Shoreham, and went onto the A27 with minimum loss of life. He did the best that he could. And as far as I'm concerned, he's a hero. In fact, as you mentioned about the negative tabloid press, that there's been, that's one half of the coin, one side. The other side, I've seen a rather remarkable positive outpouring of support in certain social media circles. There is a group on Facebook called the Andy Hill Facebook group, currently 929 members, and it's full of positive messages of support for Andy Hill. So if anyone wants to show support, I suggest people go onto that.
I was just going to dive in and just congratulate you Amjad too, and just basically say, from all the reporting I saw on Facebook on the whole thing, you took the high road, and I just wanted to give you a bit of a tip of the hat publicly for that.
Thank you, Gene. That's very gracious of you.
Yes, and as I said, there are other ways of showing your support as well.
Yes.
And before we leave the subject, we would again like to send our very best wishes to those injured and affected, and our deepest condolences to those who have lost loved ones. Right, let's talk some space then. Let's start with Tim Peake, scheduled for his first flight on the 15th of December of this year to the ISS. Tim's been on the show. He's a very gracious guy. We've been monitoring his training, which has been quite intense. But he's a fantastic ambassador, isn't he, Amjad?
Indeed he is. He throws everything and the kitchen sink into what he does for outreach, visits schools and children all over. And this is in addition to his very, very intense training schedule. I know he was back in the Soyuz sim this week, reviewing life support systems and emergency drills. And he was previously in Japan at JAXA for training too. So he's learning about genetics, drug use, and immune system experiments he'll be doing on the Japanese lab on ISS when he goes up there too.
Gene, just talking about Soyuz and the capsules, just coming away from Tim Peake, there seems to be a media storm in the US at the moment about the use of Roscosmos to get particularly the American astronauts to the ISS. Where do we stand at the moment on this?
Oh boy! Well, just a few weeks ago, there was a budget decision, like there usually is here in the American political process. It was for the NASA budget, and unfortunately, it looks like the Commercial Crew program, which for your listeners, the Commercial Crew program is set to take U.S. astronauts from U.S. soil back to the International Space Station around the year 2017. That was at least the target date. NASA has contracted out officially to two companies, Boeing and SpaceX, to go ahead and start that process. Boeing is building a capsule called the CST-100. SpaceX is expanding on its Dragon cargo vehicle, and calling this particular vehicle the Crew Dragon. Both of these ships will hold about seven astronauts, unlike Soyuz, which can only hold three. I should add, Soyuz initially was only designed to hold two, but they kind of shoehorned a third astronaut in there early on in the program.
That's a bit of an understatement, Jay.
Right, yeah. I mean, you are I mean it's like putting three guys in. If you've ever been in a Volkswagen Beetle, that's the best way I can describe Soyuz in that descent module.
But let's just hope they're all on a sushi diet then.
Yeah.
And I think the latest launch as well of the Soyuz, they're not doing the direct shot, are they? They're doing a 2-day shot. And for anyone who's seen it on TV, 2 days in that doesn't fill me with a great deal of. I don't envy them. Let's put it that way.
It's cozy. You've got, well, you do have two modules. Let's keep that in mind too. You've got the descent stage, which is essentially which oddly enough is where you're riding on the way up. And you do have that smaller orbital module up front, but it doesn't give you a whole lot of room up there. And yeah. I think this is being done. They said for, I quote, security reasons, close quote, apparently and this is something we'll probably talk about perhaps a little later. Apparently the ISS has been dodging a lot of orbital debris of late, and they want to be sure that Soyuz is also not impacted, no pun intended, by any of that. And so they're going to take the slow boat approach on this particular flight because of that.
Right. Okay. And you just mentioned there, the issue of, budgeting and that sort of thing. There's a bit of a storm at the moment about the use of the Air Force not being allowed to buy the engines, the RD-180 engines for the Atlas, but you're still paying the Roscosmos rather than investing that in either the commercial crew program or in fact in SLS.
You see, Peter, that's my point. We've basically, the U.S. Congress has taken $460 million out of the commercial crew budget. I'm trying to remember the exact request, but they tore out that amount and put it into SLS and Orion. Now, the trouble is this. The SLS program is flush with money right now, and they don't really see a lot of engineering issues. We learned a lot from Ares 5, and because of that teaching of a lot of that's been incorporated, a lot of that learning has been incorporated in the design of SLS. So SLS is chugging along and it's meeting its milestones. It's doing what it has to do to make that 2018 launch date. Ditto with Orion. Orion is quite healthy. It is also moving along. They just went in for a critical design review not too long ago. And that whole process, I believe, is going to be finished in October. And I don't foresee a lot of major bumps in that road. So both of these programs are being, healthily funded. But yet commercial crew, which is trying to get us off of the ground quickest, it's just because of the wall we kind of backed ourselves into back in 2011 when we decommissioned Shuttle. We just didn't have the program ready to go. So I'm mystified as to what the deal is. I know what the answer is. It's all politics. But my thought is really, guys, let's leave politics aside. Like it or not, because of the wall we've backed ourselves into, commercial crew is the fastest way to get U.S. astronauts off U.S. soil, launched to the International Space Station. And by the way, we leave the pressure off of Soyuz because right now we've only got one avenue to the International Space Station, and that's Soyuz.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Indeed. That is a good point. That is a good point. Let's come back to the ISS, Gene and Amjad, then. Interestingly, I digress, I'm afraid, Gene, on something you talked about on Talking Space recently, which was the growing of food in space, which I found absolutely intriguing, the role of the farmer on the good old terra firma is probably becoming highly unpopular, but actually in the new world and in space exploration, the farmer will be the most important person going out with the crews on some of these potential long duration flights. There's also something that you talked about in terms of the perception of the ISS, mm-hmm. And both in Russia and in the US. Amjad, I want to just ask you, I mean, I know how I feel about things. You're a bit more connected than I am. What's the feeling about space exploration over here and in Europe? Do you think there's an appetite for it? Because it doesn't seem to be in other parts of the world. And I just wonder if that's affecting some of these budgeting issues.
Yes. I think you're quite right there. There is, at a grassroots level, perhaps in schools, you may find children being fired up. So long as you can hold their interest, great. But at a governmental level, at a business level, certainly I don't think people are looking beyond a business quarter or political term and seeing what can be done. Though one thing I have to say, though, we have got Tim Peake, obviously, and his upcoming trip to the ISS. We are getting more of an investment into space now, having become somewhat of a larger partner in ESA as far as providing funds is concerned. So we are stepping up to the plate, finally. So that is a positive trend. We are growing, but As we know from the US as well, and lessons learned from the past, that is not accomplished in one political term. It has to be over many, many years, decade long, really. And when you look at how reliant our digital economies are on space activity, we really need to, in the UK, to do much more of a catch up. You look at our broadband connections, we were talking about it before the show.
Yeah.
We really are the third man of a poor man of Europe, really, almost like a third world economy. So we do need to have much more interest in the UK backing up those things. It's not just about manned space travel. It's about making people realize space is in our lives, every aspect of our lives. And I don't think that is yet there yet.
Let's come back to the ISS then. We saw JAXA and the HTV-5 arrive with some critical spares, food and logistical equipment for the ISS.
Thermal batteries activation. All systems are ready.
Main engine start.
Main engine ignition.
SRBA 点火、リフトオフ
SRBA 点火、リフトオフ
宇宙ステーション補給機、コウノトリ5号機を搭載した H2B ロケット5号機は平成27年8月19日
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
I'm Peter Dixon, and I listen to Extended.
Where are we then, Gene, with the whole Orion system and the review that you talked about a little while ago?
Well, Orion is still slated on... Well, the Orion capsule is still ready to go. We're actually waiting on you guys. As for folks who don't know, the service module for Orion is being built by ESA. It is loosely based on the old ATV, the automated transfer vehicle. ATV is no longer being built, but parts of it are being used for the service module for Orion. So,
Gene, sorry to interrupt you there.
Yes.
But what was the reasoning behind ESA stopping the flights up to the ISS? Why was that? Was that so that they could turn their focus on this module?
I don't, to be honest with you, it might have been a money decision. I don't know the exact reason, but my gut feeling, if I were to play intuition, is probably budget. And also, it might have been a decision that saying, well, we have Progress, we have HTV, we have the Crew Dragon, we have Antares, and I'm sorry, Cygnus, being Antares is the booster. We have Cygnus by Orbital ATK. What, you know, are we just being redundant? I mean, that might have been part of it too.
Right.
But I think what Europe did and what NASA did was to try to get Europe more involved in the exploration program and say, well, you know, why don't we go ahead and let you guys take care of the service module on Orion? Mm. And you guys had had everything pretty much ready made with ATV. So now it's just sort of modifying ATV to support Orion.
Mm. Right. Okay.
Now, Gene, correct me if I'm wrong here. You mentioned obviously the critical design reviews that have been going forward with Orion, and right. I believe that's due to finish in October.
Yes, sir.
But SLS has also been under that magnifying glass as well, and we'll also have the GSDO, the Associated Ground System, as well. That's another part of that jigsaw puzzle, so to speak. So would there be an overarching review across SLS, Orion, and GSDO for how those programs are interacting together and seeing where they are in the key stages of development and raising red flags?
Well, I would go ahead and say that each one of the programs can go ahead and raise their own red flags if they run into problems. I will say GSDO, by the way, just to give them a plug, the large tower that was initially built to support the Constellation programs Ares 5, that is just getting online. They're putting the final touches on it, I believe, in the coming weeks, and that tower should be pretty much good to go. It's huge. I was up, they invited some members of the press back for the launch of MSL. They actually gave us a tour of that tower, and we were able to go up to the top of that thing, and it was... It was a breathtaking view, I'll say that much. But and this thing was just slowly being modified from its Ares 5 connections to meet up with SLS, and that was back around 2011. Now the tower is about ready to go online. They were just, you know, making sure the all the connections were there where they're supposed to be for SLS and so on. And apparently that work is now winding down. So to answer that, it looks like GSDO is also pretty much more part of the puzzle, and they are also coming online with their equipment. I know that the infamous crawlers, they have gone through, one of them has undergone a 21st century transformation that is all set to go. I believe there's another one planned. But I'll have to check that for the second crawler. But it looks like that first crawler that they wanted to go ahead and get all the analog stuff, move it to digital. That's been done. Replace a lot of the cabling with fiber optic. That's been done. Same thing with Launchpad 39B. Some of that cabling has been around since the Apollo era. And they pulled all that old cabling out and replaced it with all, you know, fiber optic lines and fiber optic communication. There's a fuel tank not too far away from there that also has not been cleaned out since the Apollo era.
You are seriously kidding me. Wow.
I'm not joking. They've just finished cleaning that thing out. So that's all set to go. So 39B, is in lovely shape right now.
Oh, beautiful.
It's come a long way from the gasps of you know, just fright that us press types had when we saw the dismantling company coming over and pecking up the retractable service structure or the RSS on pad 39B over there and just getting rid of everything that was related to shuttle. And
I mean, it was scary. We know. Yeah, we know the historical significance of those pads, AMD. Right. And if nothing else, they should be preserved as a national landmark, I think, if they're not being used.
But A has got that designation. Pad 39A has got that designation. Forgive the interruption, but I'm not too sure about B, but 39A, because of it having been Apollo 11's embarkation point, has that designation of a national landmark.
It's been a troubling year for many launch vehicles. Of course, Wallops and Terry's almost a year ago, SpaceX, of course, and of course, Proton, and the Russians have had their own setbacks as well. Where is Antares at the moment, and what's Wallops like? Is it anywhere near coming back to use?
At last check, as reported by CEO David Thompson for Orbital ATK, Pad 0A is going to be ready to support a March 2016 launch from the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport at Wallops Island. That means Antares as well is also right on target to go ahead and continue its service also around the same day. Around the same time. In fact, Antares is scheduled to fly one more time from the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport come March 2016. It will have the new RD-191 engines, which I believe are the same engines that they're using for the Angara rocket that Roscosmos is using. And much ado has been put on the AJ-26, which is essentially a hopped up version of Russia's MK-33, which, by the way, is going back in production, I might add. Russia has decided to put that engine back into production again, I think probably because they may see a market for it in some other boosters that they want to go ahead and manufacture. But a lot of the press around here surrounding the AJ-26, everybody thought, oh, geez, you know, we just went ahead and threw 60s era Russian rockets in there. That wasn't the case. What happened was a company called Aerojet Rocketdyne imports the MK-33 engine and essentially hops it up. They made it do things that the MK-33 designers never really thought it could do. Like, I believe it has turned into you can't, like, for instance, you can't gimbal the MK-33. You can gimbal the AJ-26. So that's just one of the things that Aerojet Rocketdyne was allowing the engines to do. The problem was, I believe, in a faulty bearing, and that's what essentially caused the sad events of October 28th, 2014, and put Antares sort of in the hole, and of course Cygnus in the hole. The interesting thing about Cygnus, though, is that its company, Orbital ATK, has had a lot of experience with sort of attaching its spacecraft to other boosters, meaning that it has built stuff for folks that are launching on Ariane 5, for instance, or it has built adapters for folks that are launching on a SpaceX booster, or it's built adapters for other purposes, for the Atlas V, for instance. So it wasn't really an alien thing to go ahead and outfit Cygnus, which is the cargo vehicle, to fit on an Atlas V. So what the company did was they bought two Atlas V's and said, okay, we're going to launch Cygnus on an Atlas V from the Kennedy Space Center. That launch is coming up in December. I believe they have bought one more Atlas with an option for more. And that's one of the reasons why NASA, I think, decided to go with Orbital ATK for two more cargo flights. We do have a contract coming up in November. NASA's postponed the decision on the contract twice, I believe, on who's going to be awarded the next round of commercial cargo contracts. But I think the reason why they postponed it is because they want to see how quickly SpaceX can get back online after its little you know, debacle, unfortunately, that occurred this summer. So they're going to watch and see how quickly SpaceX handles their little issue, and in turn, how quickly they can bounce back. The interesting thing I will say, and in indifference to orbital ATK, was they had a get ahead plan within 6 days of the accident, and presented that get ahead plan to stockholders. I'm still not too sure what the get ahead plan is for SpaceX just yet. I know they are investigating the problem, and I know there's a lot of people in Congress, for instance, saying, you know, SpaceX investigating itself. What is this? Well, you got to remember too, Orbital ATK is doing the same thing, but they brought in a set of outside experts to go ahead and help investigate what had occurred. And I believe that final report should be due in the not too distant future. I know one of the members of that panel was a former associate administrator Wayne Hale, who was also the project manager for the space shuttle program at one point. So, you know, they didn't bring in, you know, just a lot of, you know, slouches in trying to find out what went wrong here. So we're going to find out for sure what happened. And I have all confidence that Orbital will go ahead, take care of itself, and ditto SpaceX too. I mean, NASA goes into these things knowing that they're going to get bit by this. But in the same vein too, it's not really all that great that, you know, these things happen. In fact, you know, at the top of this conversation, you mentioned the HTV-5 docking. There was about maybe, I think HTV carried about 8,000 pounds of logistics up there. And I think they had to add a little bit more because of the SpaceX mishap.
Yeah, that's right. I think they did.
So this was really, really critical getting this up there. Had this thing failed, it really would have put us behind the eight ball, I think, as far as supplies. But now that it's there, I think we're in good shape.
Well, let's just have a look at some other nations then. Let's just park the ISS and NASA for a while. It's not, they've not been the only ones active in the last year or so since we last talked, Gene. Of course, we've seen the Indians launch to Mars, and they're set to launch their first astronomical satellite as well. But I suppose the intriguing question is, what will the Chinese be up to? Of course, we saw Jade Rabbit, the moonshot, and the launch of that on the Chang'e 3. We've also seen Europe, the European nations and ESA talking to China about working more closely. Where's all this going? Are we going to get to a point, do you think, where we might be able to see some international cooperation across the whole world in terms of space exploration?
Well, I think politics, unfortunately, is going to get in the way of some of that. I don't think because of politics and because of things going on, I don't think we're all ready to sit around the campfire and sing Kumbaya just yet. Something, because a lot of people around here, at least in the United States, at least some in the space community, have been saying, well, why don't we just go ahead and cooperate with China? As I have said, I don't see that happening. I don't see Congress allowing it for some time because of trust issues. Yeah. Basically, that when you want to cooperate with another power, there has to be some sort of level of intrinsic trust there. Everybody points to, well, we did it with Apollo Soyuz. Yeah, but you have to remember too, the way Nixon used that was, we were already in a period of détente or a period of sort of relaxing of tensions when Apollo Soyuz was introduced. Right. Yeah. And when that happened in 1975, we were pretty much on that level and pretty much trying to say the Cold War is over. We're going to start trying to cooperate with each other. But that trust was already being established. We haven't established any air of trust with China just yet. So I'm dubious really of hearing that we're going to go ahead and see China on board the International Space Station anytime soon. I just don't see it right now.
I'll back you up on that, Gene, because I'm sure you've seen this as well with visiting dignitaries, Chinese scientists, and so on. Every time they go to various NASA sites or so on, they have a fully armed escort, and certain elements and areas are off limits to them. Which just goes to prove your point.
Yeah, there's got to be trust, and I just don't see that trust developing between the U.S. and China just yet. That's got to work, and that has to work through diplomatic channels. And in order for us to begin to work together with China, and at least from the United States standpoint, that trust has to be established.
Yes.
What about the Indians? Where do we see them in effect in this new space race, I think, that we're seeing evolving at the moment? We saw the MOM mission, of course, to Mars last year. Very, very inexpensive, maybe the best way of putting it. Now, it certainly doesn't have a great deal of functionality either, but they're certainly doing an awful lot.
Let's just say it was quick and dirty. They did it the best they could. I probably could have got a better deal doing it from my uncle, actually. But it just goes to show that India does have the appetite. There is the skill set there, but I'm sure if they wanted to add more to the burden of what's going on a spacecraft, they would probably need to reach out, but I think they have that open hand of friendship. They would encourage people to come on board. I'm not sure how they would be with getting into a partnership with China and the US.
I think politics for that triumvirate would be far too challenging, wouldn't it? And another emerging nation I've been hearing a lot more about, I've not seen a great deal from, but we've seen the airline industry go through a massive change in the last decade, and behemoths of airlines coming out of the Middle East. The United Arab Emirates has also starting to dip its toe into space exploration as well. Where do we see them probably in the next 10 to 20 years?
Wow, that's a real big one. I'm not too sure where they are in their program. I know they want to go ahead and launch their own satellite package.
Yeah, I think that's where they're starting.
That's where we all really have started. We go ahead and we launch our own little scientific package and try to build from that point. Where do I see them going? If they're able to go ahead and be successful, they may be run at the commercial satellite launch business the same way everybody else is, because that's right now where the money is.
Well, they've certainly got a lot of it as well, so I think they've got as good a chance as anyone.
Another thing too I should mention with the Indian Space Research Organization is just this past week, and it's Sunday, August 30th as we record this, India launched its own cryogenic engine. It launched a communications payload using a cryogenic engine. This was a paid commercial satellite that they launched, but this is a big step for India. And it will go ahead and enhance their abilities going further. Also, just as an addendum to the China story that we were just talking about, NanoRacks has gone ahead and kind of partnered with a Chinese company, not the Chinese government, a Chinese company, for an experiment to fly on one of their racks. And this is kind of drawn the ire a little bit of the U.S. Congress. So this is on their radar, and they're going to be watching this very, very closely to make sure that this isn't violating any ITAR agreements or anything like that. So just watch that in the news. It'll be interesting to see.
Listen, let's take a quick break there then. Still to come, we've got lots to talk about on New Horizons, Rosetta, Cassini, and an awful lot more.
Game challenge begins. Launch. Circular orbit. Rapid rendezvous. Intercept and dock with International Space Station.
All engine running.
Push the ISS to higher orbit. Rescue EVA astronauts. Avoid space debris. Destroy debris with missiles. Protect the ISS. For as long as possible. Deorbit. Land. Survive.
All in a day's work.
We had a pretty large bank.
We've had a problem here. Both control,
both auto, command override off. We've had shutdown. Leo, Low Earth Orbit. A game from SkyrocketCafe.com.
3, 2, 1.
Well, I think one of the most exciting things in space exploration at the moment is the number of missions that are going on from almost every angle. We'll come to New Horizons in a minute and some of the amazing stuff that is starting to trickle through there. But just a little look back at Rosetta. And of course, we all know that the lander Philae made its day on 67P. That's now around the other side of the sun. The latest news on that is that ESA are having a bit of trouble with Philae communicating back to Rosetta at the moment. I think some of the packets of data are getting lost. What I have heard, though, is that Philae is in good health. It's well charged. Its batteries are well charged. And there's another opportunity, I think, in around October time for Philae to talk to Rosetta and, of course, for some of that data to come back to us. So fingers crossed there. It's been a fantastic mission. They've had a fantastic year. There's some great photographs coming out of ESA on Rosetta, particularly as 67P starts to trail. I believe they're going to take the spacecraft away from 67P and put it slightly back towards the cloud a little bit. I think they're taking about 1,000 kilometres back. So it'd be interesting to see what news we get of Philae and Rosetta in a month or two's time. But New Horizons seems to be where all the excitement is. Gene, I know you've got a great deal of involvement and information that potentially is going to come to us on this. But let me come to you, Amjad. We see it from a distance, I suppose, in many ways. Where are you on New Horizons and what it's brought to us?
Well, you're talking about distance. That's quite a lot, 3 billion miles and 9 hours of round-trip time away. I mean, it's been an amazing story. It really has. And the latest thing that's just come out of the gates has been the identification of a new potential target, a new Kuiper Belt object, which will be a secondary mission proposal. Now, I believe that that has been submitted to NASA by the New Horizons team to fund an extended mission. So naturally, NASA will have to review and assess that before an official approval is given to extend the mission. But that'll just extend the sampling of the diversity of Kuiper Belt objects in this unexplored region of the solar system, and like the Pluto flyby, can help us revolutionize our understanding of the Kuiper Belt objects as well.
But we've still got a lot of stuff, Gene, to come down from New Horizons, haven't we? We haven't seen a half of it, even though some of the stuff we've been teased with looks quite amazing.
Oh yeah, Peter, the rest of the data, there's still data coming down now from New Horizons. I should mention that data that's coming on down at least this month is mostly engineering data from the spacecraft. It's sort of, yes, this is healthy, this is working, that kind of stuff. And so the engineering team is going to go ahead and evaluate and see where we are with the health of the spacecraft. We're going to get more science data starting in mid to late September. And once that avalanche science data starts, it will continue to start probably pretty much through next October, because as Amjad, you pointed out, the bandwidth issues and so on that we're dealing with here, it takes about maybe 4 hours to get the information back from the spacecraft and then communicate it back over there. So really 9 hours round trip to get information back and forth. But that cache of data, and its data store is pretty much all filled, is going to be just absolutely mind-blowing compared to what we've seen thus far. What came down the first couple of days before the actual flyby, as for folks that were not following this during the flyby in this past summer, that data was how Alan Stern characterized it as the contingency sample data, the way they did it on Apollo 11, say, where, you know, Armstrong would have to go ahead and pick up a couple of rocks in the event we had to, you know, he had to leave the surface rather rapidly. So that's what we were doing. We were getting a lot of data together that also that data as we approached Pluto was used for situational awareness data. In the event that we hit something along the way, I believe there was a 1 in 10,000 chance that New Horizons may have impacted something that we didn't see. If we lost the spacecraft through that, at least we would have something to go back. Go
ahead. Indeed, we had a little bit of a hiccup on the approach, didn't we, where New Horizons actually shut down.
That's correct. They went ahead, worked that problem, brought her back, and she was back up and functioning. But the whole idea, too, was, you know, you're moving at quite a clip. You're moving at about 36,000 miles an hour. So you don't have a lot of you want to know what's in front of you. That's most important. So then this way you don't hit anything while you're flying by everything. And that's what we were trying to do on approach. And there was some nail biting going on at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory. There was a lot of confidence. I was there during the flyby. There were actually two flyby events. One was at about 7:52 in the morning, which was the actual time that the spacecraft flew by the planet. Yes, everybody was calling it a planet. I should mention that. a lot of people were. They were just seeing a lot of people saying, yes, I called it a planet. There, I said it. That seemed to be the general consensus.
I think everyone at Johns Hopkins says that, yeah.
We all think it's a planet. Come on.
We all think it is, definitely.
Yeah. But there was that moment, and there was a lot of flag waving. There was a lot of, you know, buttons being, you know, lost on shirts and things like that. There was a lot of pride in that auditorium. But then the nail biting started, and some of the press I did notice were asking some of the scientists about, you know, in the event you lost the vehicle, what was this? What was that? What was the other thing? And one of them turned to who I'm somewhat friendly with, turned to me and said, you know, I wasn't nervous up until that point. and I said, you know, don't worry about it. Look, I said to the individual, I said, look, here's the deal. You've taught her everything she needs to know. She's on her own. She'll be okay. Don't worry. And lo and behold, at about 8:52 that evening, we all found out when New Horizons said, okay, guys, I'm here. Now what do you want me to do? I've got all this treasure trove of data here. Should I start transmitting?
This is just so amazing, though, isn't it, Gene? I'm sorry to interrupt you there. I mean, you just talk about, you know, hiccups, they got it fixed. This thing is billions of miles from us. We've seen landing on a comet from, you know, from Rosetta in the last year. We've still got to talk about what's going on around Saturn and what Dawn is up to. I mean, this is amazing stuff, isn't it? It's fantastic.
It's a golden age. It really is a golden age, isn't it? I mean, you're talking about threading the astronomical needle from 3 billion miles out, and now we've flown by Pluto within 7,800 miles. We've gathered 50 gigabytes of data over 9 days of that close approach. It's just astounding the age that we live in and what we can accomplish here.
Gene, let's move on then to back to Saturn. Cassini, it's done some fantastic work, but it's coming to an end, isn't it, in a year or so's time?
That's correct. Cassini is going to make its fiery plunge into the atmosphere of Saturn. This is, again, because of planetary contamination rules and things like that. You don't want to go ahead and leave the spacecraft kind of wandering where it could, you know, crash into something while it's there. So you want to go ahead and bring it in controlled and have a controlled destruction of the vehicle, because it's no longer really viable at this point. It's losing fuel and what have you. It has done yeoman's work since its launch in 1997. Just figure that one out. Just keep that in mind on how long this vehicle has been on site and dealing with sending back some wonderful data. But it did send back some photographs during its last pass of Saturn's moon Dione. It passed about 295 miles, or for those folks that are in kilometers, it was 474 kilometers above Dione's surface. It was basically the fifth encounter with Dione during Cassini's long tour of Saturn. This was the closest approach ever since December 2011, which was at a distance of about 100 kilometers or 60 miles. So if anybody wants to go ahead and take a look at that, it's up on the NASA website. Some wonderful pictures there. Again, Cassini's done some grand work, and I'm just to echo. Yeah, I think we are seeing, we're on the cusp of a golden age, but we're not there yet, I don't think. There's some challenges ahead with budget and what have you. Mm. And there's not a lot of missions planned for the next 3 years, which has got a lot of people kind of concerned. Although we do have, you know, as far as deep space, we do have InSight coming up for Mars in 2016. And of course, the Mars 2020 rover, which is going to be a quasi-sample return mission, meaning that it's going to be packing samples in for return, but we don't have the means just yet to get that sample return package back from Mars.
Yeah.
So I think the idea is to possibly have at one point maybe a future crew to retrieve those samples or something along those lines. But who knows what the game plan is going to be for that. I would still have a feeling that it's going to be a robotic transfer where a robot will just come up, pick up the things and throw it in and send it back home. That's my opinion. But
Gino, I want to come back to Mars. I do want to come back to Mars. But before we do, I just also wanted to have a little mention of Dawn as well, and the amazing stuff that Dawn is doing, the Dawn mission, which, again, outside of, I say, special interest groups, isn't getting a great deal of mention in the general press. And again, it's letting down what's really going on out there. And it means like people like Amjad and you have to work harder at being ambassadors for this sort of thing. But there's fantastic stuff going on at Dawn. You know, it's coming up to its second destination, sending some fantastic photographs back as Ceres. I mean, this is amazing stuff.
Yeah, exactly. We still don't know what that white spot is, by the way, that Dawn found.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just, you know, that's still a bit of a puzzle. And we're still trying to ascertain what that's all about. They did find at the latest battery of photographs, they did find a large mountain there. I think it's, Amjad, correct me on this one. It's about 4 miles high.
I think it is. Yeah. Slapping in the middle. Yeah.
I mean, Ceres itself is posing a lot more questions as well as much as Pluto is.
Mm, definitely.
And if you will, if people want to go ahead and follow the Dawn mission, it's dawn.jpl.nasa.gov. And I would really, really encourage folks, and this is just a plug. There's the chief engineer of the mission, a gentleman by the name of Mark Raymond, has a blog for the Dawn mission, and I would really encourage everybody to take a look at that. He's a wonderful writer, and he can really make the complex sound absolutely simple. So if you really want to get some tremendous insight in what's going on with Dawn, follow, you know, go ahead and take a look at the the Dawn website, but also take a look at Mark Raymond's blog. I mean, he's been writing this blog since Dawn began, since the dawn of Dawn.
he's highly personable as well. Yeah.
Yeah. He's an amazing guy. I mean, you know, Amjad, we were both there, at his discussion at Space Fest 6 just last year. And he's an electrifying speaker. I mean, if you want to go ahead and go to school on how to do a public talk, that, you know, just watch him. But again, Dawn is unveiling things about Ceres that are just, that really got us scratching our head. And we just, that's leaving a heck of a lot more questions than we have answers. And I guess that's the fun part about it.
Yeah.
We'll leave that there. I do want to have another quick break, and we're going to come back and I'm going to talk to you about Mars.
Cinq, quatre, trois, deux, un, top. Allumage Vulcain. Allumage EAP, décollage.
This is a new and strange environment at first, this suddenly finding yourself in orbit.
Okay, we couldn't have a program talking about space and space exploration without talking about Mars. Of course, there's some fantastic cinema coming up very soon, which we're all quite excited about seeing. But first of all, we've got to talk about Mars One. They're hanging on by their fingernails at the moment, but they still think that they're going to be able to do this. You talked about this on the last episode of Talking Space, Gene. Where are things at with them?
Oh, boy. Well, at the latest, the Mars Society had their meeting a few weeks ago. Mars Society is a nonprofit group dedicated to Mars exploration and eventually colonization. I have some arguments with the Mars Society in a lot of ways, but that's just me. Well, one of these events at the Mars Society conference was a bit of a debate between the Mars One group and the MIT group that did a study a couple of years back, saying that Mars One's plan is just completely and totally unworkable. In fact, if they actually did get to Mars, according to this MIT study, the entire colony would be dead within a matter of 68 days. Bas Landestorp, and I'm probably mauling the man's name, I do apologize, says, who leads Mars One, is basically saying, oh, no, that's not the case at all, and all this. And well, they went ahead at this event and presented the data. The MIT folks used Apollo, essentially, as their yardstick. And they said, okay, so here's the deal. We had the construction of and design of the lunar module, the construction and the design of the command service module. We had the construction and design of the Saturn 1B and the Saturn 5. All of that cost an estimated amount of $102 billion. And there were over 8 years. And there were how many lunar flights altogether? You know, so, and of course, you have to put the lunar rover in there and all the J mission equipment in there and so on and so forth. All of that cost $102 billion, right? So now we go over to Mars One. They have a demonstration lander that is built around, I believe, the Mars Phoenix lander design. In fact, they had a contract at one point with Lockheed Martin. And that contract has since fallen through, and I believe that was reported back in February of this year. We had two comm satellites that were going to be launched. And again, they had some sort of, I don't believe that ever even reached a contract level. We have what they call an intelligent rover that would go ahead and try to see what was going on and scout out the landing area. We had a transit habitat for, you know, the initial colonists to arrive. We have several landers and surface habitat vehicles that are going to be there. Plus, let me see, according to the estimates, and again, I'm looking at a Tech Insider article, They are saying, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'm going to go on a limb and say about 12 SpaceX launches of the Falcon Heavy, which, by the way, has not launched yet. And they claim that this is going to cost $6 billion.
Right.
Gene, you talked about SpaceX there. Do they have an agreement with SpaceX?
No, that's the funny thing is.
It's all supposition, isn't it?
Yes. I believe Gwynn Shotwell has basically said they have not been approached by anybody from Mars One. So, and a lot of the stuff that they're talking about is dependent on some SpaceX technologies. In fact, if you see some of the photographs and some of the artist depictions, they are using Elon Musk has called Red Dragon, which would land literally on Mars. And that has not – that Red Dragon is still on the drawing board.
SpaceX had something to say about using their intellectual property, I suppose, in Mars One's images at all?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm sure they're sort of not happy of the fact that they're being sort of dragged in on it. it's just not – never mind the game plan itself, okay – which I think is preposterous. Mars One simply doesn't have the money. At last check, I believe they have a pot of money that has basically come from the sale of swag and other things. And the pot of money, I think, is not even capable of buying a modest sized Cessna. Let alone,
a Falcon 9 Heavy. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The accoutrements you're going to need to get to Mars.
Yeah.
The thing was that at the event, and this was reported by, Kat Robeson on Talking Space, she said, oh, but there's another, thing in the bag here. They're hoping that some billionaire is going to come out of the woodwork and say, yeah, we want to fund this. Say somebody wants to call the first town on Mars Gatesville or something like that. My question is this. Okay, say it. I'll play devil's advocate. I'm Warren Buffett. I own Berkshire Hathaway, one of the most wealthiest companies on the planet.
Yeah.
Why would I want to bankroll you? Tell me, what is your business case? I don't know what it is.
They don't have anything.
That's just it. How does Berkshire Hathaway, and this is hypothetical. This is not I want to just say that right out of the woodwork. I'm just pulling that name out because it's on the top of my head. How does Berkshire Hathaway, get its investment back?
Yeah.
There is no plan for this. It's a business, like it or not. And if you're going to approach it like a business, if I am, quote, an investor, how do I get a return on my investment? Is it from spinoffs? Is it from something else? How do I do it? I don't know. That's not articulated.
Gene, I'm going to put you out your misery there. Let's leave Mars One and talk about, I suppose, realistic plans for exploration of the planet. Of course, we've got the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that's gone through a whole decade around the planet, and of course it's still doing sterling work there. It's going to be a fundamental part of the plans moving forwards. But one of the interesting things that you put out on Facebook recently was this whole psychological issue that NASA is starting to look at in terms of long space flights and the challenges and the psychology around that. And they're starting to look at the human factors potential of Mars flight.
That's correct. And this is something to bring us full circle in a way. This is what also the ISS has kind of setting up shop and trying to do. You mentioned the agricultural end of things. You got to learn how to grow your food. And that's another problem I'm going to go ahead and throw out there that we have not solved yet. We have to go ahead and learn how to live off the land. What is there that we can use? What kind of systems do we have in place that can start, reproducing fuel and so on that we can get directly from, say, resources on site on Mars?
We're back to the early days of pioneering.
as well. Right, exactly. Yeah. And these are the things we have to solve in order to go there. But to go to the psychological standpoint of it, again, this is part and parcel to of Scott Kelly's one-year mission that we're doing as well. And I'm sure that there's evaluation there. There's another project that's going on right now. I believe it's called High Seas, that an entire team is going to be living in an enclosure somewhere.
That's right.
Right.
I think I saw something about that today, actually. I believe that that's started. I think it's a year or so? Yeah.
That's correct. Yeah. Right. And that's one of the things that they're trying to do, how a small group is going to go ahead and not only work together to achieve, certain goals, how are the group dynamics going to work? And that is, again, part and parcel, too, of what you're going to see as far as what High Seas are doing. Because we've learned something, at least from Mir and from ISS, the same kind of, personality that can fly a two-week shuttle mission isn't necessarily the same kind of personality that would do well on a long-term space flight. And that's one of the things we have discovered thus far. Yeah. So it takes a special kind of, a little bit more of a laid back kind of personality to go ahead and deal with a long term space flight.
It would be interesting to see what kind of typical or atypical, you might call, psychological profiles that would be required for a multi-year journey or multi-month journey, and then for staying out there and coming up against these hardships. Certainly, as you mentioned, they would have to be affable and get along, certainly diplomatic as well, but being able to be robust and resilient, not just within the team, but within themselves as well for any hardships too.
Yeah, and just being locked up in that tiny space. I mean, coming back to our Soyuz discussion earlier on in the program, where we're talking about the size of that capsule, these people are going to be locked in a very, very small space for what, 8 or 9 months at least, just getting there.
Yeah,
and not only that, but they are going to be the first human beings that will see Earth recede and become a pale blue dot, if you will. Yeah. And how does that play on?
Indeed.
Excuse me. Yeah. On you from a psychological basis. We don't know yet. So we've got to work on that. That's another thing that we need to work on. So when I hear people say, oh, we're ready to go to Mars now. No, we're not. We still have a lot of homework to do. We're not. And this has got nothing to do with being risk averse. We're just trying to go ahead and make sure that we're taking the calculated risks and allowing this first expedition, whoever those individuals are, that they will go ahead and have the best possible means of getting back home and making this mission a rousing success.
I think I heard it best like saying that there's an old proverb, failing to plan is planning to fail.
Thank you.
I think that covers off exactly what you just said there.
On that note, I think we're going to wrap the discussion up. Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Amjad. Fascinating stuff, as always. Something a bit different today. Hope you enjoyed that discussion. We may do a few more of these discussion-focused episodes in the future. So we'd appreciate your feedback on some possible areas to look at. We're also interested in seeing if you might like to join us in these discussions. With things like Hangouts, this is possible. Okay, that's it then. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and to ESA, JAXA and NASA for the use of the audio clips. You can find Extended now on Stitcher.com, UKPodcast.com, ThePodDirectory.com, and of course on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Gene, thank you very much for joining us. Where can we find you online?
If you're looking for me, I can be found on Twitter at GeneJM29, or I'm on Facebook. Just look me up. And, of course, look up Talking Space, www.talkingspaceonline.com, and we're also available on iTunes. So if you want to download us, please, by all means, subscribe. We'll be more than happy to have you on board.
Amjad, thank you very much for joining us as well. Where can we find you?
Great to be here again. I can be found on Twitter again, like you guys, at AmjadPZady. I'm also on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and plus, of course, at RocketSTEM, the magazine I write for. That's www.rocketstem.org.
Yeah, and of course, I just want to reinforce the points that Amjad and Gene have just made. Talking Space is an absolutely fascinating program to listen to. If you liked the little dip of our toe into the space stories that we've just gone into every couple of weeks, you get that on Talking Space. So do go over and look at it. Rocket STEM, free magazine, all about aerospace and space exploration. Again, fantastic read. So do go and download your free copy of that as well. You can find me, Peter Johnson, at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. This is an XTP Media production supported by Global Aviation Resource and the Royal Aeronautical Society. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Gene McCulker.
Thanks again, Peter. It's quite an honour to talk to your audience. Always a joy to be here.
And it's goodbye from Amjad Zaidi.
Thanks so much, Peter. Great to talk to you and Gene again, and hopefully your audience members enjoyed this show.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Suggestions? No. All right. Well, we'll go with New Horizons then, shall we? That's pretty popular and in everyone's faces at the moment. Sorry, folks. I was on mute.
Oh, okay.
I was talking to myself.
I am in you.
There's me telling everyone to mute when you're not talking. It's no good when you are talking, is it? What a dope. So I know you hate talking about Mars One, but let's...
Okay!
happy thoughts, Gene.
Ethan, mate, maybe in the director's cut of this, you put in Matt Damon's Will Science the sh** out of this.
One more time.
That might make the outtakes, Amjad. Be careful.
The name of the darn place just slipped my mind.
Wallops.
No. Okay, take two. Bang.
Of the craft, I don't even know what it looks like. I've seen.
It's like a grand piano with a dish.
It's about the size of a grand piano. It's a really small little thing. I mean, as Alan Stern described it, he felt back in 2006 when the spacecraft was launched, he said something to the effect that it felt like a hood ornament on the rest of this Atlas V, because this Atlas V was armed to the teeth, and it actually had to have another booster on board to go ahead and which by the way, this was before the Boeing merger and so on. This was before Launch Alliance was created, because this was Atlas V was essentially a Lockheed Martin critter. But what they had to do is they had to put an additional kick booster on the Atlas V, and that kick booster was built by Boeing. And you would think that there was a lot of, you know, infighting between the two organizations. There wasn't at all. Both organizations were pumped. They couldn't believe they were part of something like this, and they really, really went above and beyond to make sure that that vehicle was set to go.
I think it was like 470 kilograms, and Voyager 1 was 7,200 kilograms, I think. And
to give you an idea, I mean, this thing was launched in the afternoon, and about 9 hours later, it was beyond the orbit.
Yeah. Wow.
I trust you implicitly. No, sir.
Don't say that. We do have fun with the outtakes.
Yeah.
The outtakes. Oh no!
Oh no!
As I think I've said before, many of our listeners start at the back of the program first.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.